It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to a Milwaukee DJ who says hip-hop music in the city is experiencing a resurgence with young new artists getting national attention.
First, the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction announced yesterday that it's seeking an additional $613 million in funding from the state budget during the coming 2 years.
The proposal would change the state's public school funding formula, which has been criticized as exacerbating inequalities among affluent and poor public school districts, and it would also increase the amount of money that schools can raise through local taxes.
It also includes specific funding for special ed, English language learning, technical education, and school safety.
Here with us now to talk about the request from the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards. Aaron, welcome back.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, but I'm not talking on behalf of the DPI, just to be clear.
Oh, no, talking about the request from the DPI, you're with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Sure.
To clarify.
Great,
so how does this $600 million request, increased request, compare with previous budget requests from the DPI?
Well, in the last two rounds of budget requests in 2010 and 2012, State Superintendent Tony Evers has asked for more money for schools. Understandably, the department feels that schools are underfunded, that they need more money to be able to provide the services they do to children. And so the state superintendent has stepped up and said, this is what we think is necessary. And that increase, that $613 million increase, represents about a 2.5% increase in state aid in the first year of the budget, and then almost a 5% increase in the second year of that 2015-2017 budget.
And what's the response been to the previous couple of requests from the DPI?
With a Republican-controlled legislature that has been conservative in their funding for schools, those requests have not gotten a very warm reception. Certainly in 2010, we saw the governor and the legislature approve a significant decrease to state aid, and perhaps more importantly for districts, that limit on how much they could raise in local property taxes to make up for that budget shortfall. So we haven't really seen the legislature be eager here to really send a whole lot of new funding to schools. And I think some people would say that's a little bit of an unrealistic request. But you have to, you know, as one state lawmaker said, a Republican, you know, you have to give them credit for asking what they think is appropriate. Mm-hmm.
And with a bigger Republican majority, one that people have described as even maybe more consistently conservative in the past, have we started to see reaction from legislative leaders yet?
Well, we just had the election, so a lot of people aren't really eager to go out on a limb and say anything bold. But certainly we've seen indications that the legislature and the Republican majority are very interested in cutting taxes, dealing with this $680 million transportation fund shortfall, potentially expanding the number of private schools that get public money. Those are referred to as private school vouchers. And so we just haven't seen any indication yet that there's a big appetite for sending a lot of new money to public schools.
Let's dig a little deeper into what the DPI is asking for. Now, Wisconsin school funding formula is, it's big, it's complex, it's a really significant part of the state budget. Apart from asking for more money, what is the DPI looking to change in the way schools are funded?
For the third time, the DPI is asking for a significant shift in how we allot money to schools. So, for example, right now, you may have a lot of kids who actually come from homes considered to be low income in certain rural or more sparsely populated areas of the state. But some of those communities also have a lot of property tax wealth because they've got big vacation homes around lakes in the area. So they appear to be wealthy communities, even though the kids themselves that are attending the schools year-round are not so wealthy. Those schools and districts are disadvantaged in the current funding formula. So what the state superintendent would like to do is even that out and say, okay, no matter where you are, if you're a kid in a public school, that public school district is going to get $3,000 in per pupil funding for each one of those children. And then we're going to, you know, adjust some other parts of the formula to make sure that we're, you know, kind of evening out the issues related to property values and how we're going to give money to kids. And then we're also going to give you, for example, if you have bilingual students or English language learner students, each one of those students is going to get $100 more in funding. So they're trying to kind of even it out and then send more money to the kids that we know cost more to educate.
Now, a lot of the increases that the DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, is asking for, they're saying, hey, state, as I understand it, can you just pay for this flat out? Are they also looking to increase the amount they could collect in local property taxes, lift that cap that districts currently face?
Right. That's kind of the confusing part of the formula. The schools get aid from, or they get their money from two main sources, the state general aid and then the amount that they can raise locally in property taxes and state aid. And under Governor Walker, we saw a big swing, a reduction in that. Instead of it being an increase, it was actually a decrease. Schools were not allowed to raise more money per pupil to kind of keep up with expenses of school districts, which is, you know, we triggered a lot of other actions that resulted in streamlining funding in the schools. Going forward, the state superintendent is saying, you know, it's really realistic to tie this property tax limit increase or this amount that you can raise per student every year should sort of be tied to the rate of inflation. So for the next 2 years, or at least in the next two-year budget cycle, they're asking for at least a $200 increase per pupil in the amount that districts can raise in state aid and local property taxes. So that would give them the ability to raise more money locally to fund operations for students.
Now, are we seeing anything about how voucher schools are paid for in this budget request?
The budget request does address the fact that that voucher schools and independent charter schools, those are the public schools that operate separate from school districts, that those have to be paid for. So, for example, you see a line that says this is how much we expect to have to pay for charter schools based on the increased payment for each of those students that the legislature approved in the last session. Same for example, the Milwaukee Voucher Program. The DPI estimates that 1,000 more students each year in the two-year budget, so 2,000 more students total will join the Milwaukee Voucher Program. We know that the state payment for those students has also gone up. Used to be around $6,500. Now it's closer to $7,000, a little bit more, depending on whether they're in middle school or high school. So the DPI is saying we recognize that we're sending money for those, but they're not really asking for an increase in aid for those programs. They're mostly just acknowledging this is how many more kids we project. This is how much money will have to be allocated for them.
Now, another funding area that I know some school districts are struggling with is a special education funding. What does the request do when it comes to special ed?
So there's a pretty significant ask here for special ed students. It does a couple of different things. It tries to get some more baseline funding to schools that serve students with special needs. But then there's some other sort of special requests for them. For example, there's a pretty big request for money for programs that help students with special needs transition from high school into some kind of meaningful program after high school. We see a similar request for traditional ed students transitioning from high school sort of in a career track into a technical program as well. But I think it's pretty significant, especially, you know, we've been hearing from the disability advocates groups that have said, you know, we think it's really important to send more money here because there's a growing need for quality services for students with special needs, and we have to help them transition to meaningful work after they get out of the K-12 system.
In the run-up to the elections, I know assembly leadership laid out some priorities, and that included expanding voucher schools, school choice in the state. Any indication that there's an appetite to tackle really any of these other areas that the Department of Public Instruction is calling for?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Luther Olson, a Republican senator, he's the chair of the Education Committee, knows a lot about schools, has been in the legislature for a long time. You know, he said that there's probably an appetite to give schools something. We can't know this for sure, but I mean, I think there has to be some kind of acknowledgement that costs go up every year. So I think we could expect that schools may get something more than they're getting now. But where that is going to be, you know, is it going to be 10 cents? Is it going to be 50 cents? Is it going to be, you know, being a little loose there? But, you know, we just don't know what the increase could be. In terms of these other specialized programs for special ed and bilingual education, there's even a request for $2 million in grants for districts to fund safety programs and ask for money to create a Wisconsin School Safety Center that would focus on emergency preparations and issues that we've certainly seen in schools around the country when it comes to violence in schools. I haven't heard anyone say, absolutely, that's going to be a win for me. I'm really going to gun for that I'm really going to push for that. So we're just not hearing a lot of feedback yet from lawmakers that they really love some of these proposals and would push them forward.
We'll be watching that next year. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Erin Richards. She's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter. We've been talking about the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction's request for an increased $613 million in funding over the next 2 years.
If you haven't been following the hip-hop scene in Milwaukee, you may not know that right now, things are looking up. According to our next guest, the scene is enjoying a resurgence that it hasn't seen for several years. Back in the early to mid-2000s, hip-hop artists in the city were attracting some big attention, but then things slowed down until recently.
Now young artists are taking the reins, using social media to gain fans and setting up their own shows, escaping the music industry hierarchy and doing it themselves.
Here to talk about Milwaukee's hip-hop scene and share some of the artists gaining traction is DJ Bizon, a.k.a. Tyrone Miller. He's one half of the show Those Hip-Hop Guys, which airs live Tuesday nights from 9 till midnight on WMSE 91.7 in Milwaukee. And he joins us now from Milwaukee. Bizon, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So what was the Milwaukee hip-hop scene like back in the 2000s?
Well, there was just a lot of collaborations. There was a lot of just regular people knowing what was going on. There was so much support throughout with the venues around the city. So you had, you know, a hip-hop show or hip-hop night, theme night going on almost every night of the week. And so there was just so much support, so many people talking about it. And if you were a new artist or a new, you know, trying to get involved, there were very easy avenues to do that in. And then, you know, late 2000s, like 2009, 2010, it just slowed down a bit. You know, some of those venues started to shut down. Less people were doing shows. And it just wasn't as easy to get in or see what was going on or, you know, even pay attention if you were just a casual fan. And now recently it's just booming. I mean, it's really cool to see. And some of these younger artists, and we're talking about 16, 17, 18, really being independent and doing their own thing. So a lot of times if you're an artist in any genre of music, you're hoping to get some coverage from some blogs, from some, you know, radio shows or whatever. They don't care. They're not waiting. They're doing their shows. They're making videos and they're telling their friends, and the word can spread because, like you said earlier, with social media and just the way the internet works, they can do whatever they want and people will see it. People will hear it and people will pay attention.
So you said the scene hit a lull after being pretty booming in the early part of the 2000s. So what happened to pull it out, and what were the first signs of that?
Well, I just think more people just kept trying. So you have some artists that have been around for a very long time. So you had like the Rusty P's and King Hell Bastard and, you know, the Umbrella Music Group label. That's just to name a few, but they've been around, you know, since that time. And they just kept chugging along. The network that they built throughout just their careers just stayed strong. And so then a lot of these younger artists, so I think when you see a national artist like a Kendrick Lamar or J. Cole, you know, rapping about and speaking about what they want to talk about, not having to kind of, you know, conform to some industry standards or, you know, dumb themselves down, that I think that brought some energy. Along with the Kanye West, too, you know, so seeing these younger artists speak very highly of him in terms of really speaking about what you want to speak about and that platform being built. And so with that, along with social media, along with here in Milwaukee, even like a Radio Milwaukee or a WMSC, being able to play some of that music where they didn't have that opportunity in the past, it really just sparked everybody to start putting some music out and making some stuff happen.
Well, you shared some of these artists with us so we could listen to some of the music. And one of those that you're talking about is an artist named Ishtar. Can you tell us about him?
So Ishtar is a very interesting story. So he randomly one day, I was checking my SoundCloud account, and he said, hey, check out my music. That was it. That was my introduction to him. And it was really great. It was really interesting. It was really creative from all angles. And it was really cool to hear this young dude. He was in high school, maybe 16 or 17, I forget, but just had really good music. And then out of nowhere, just started seeing him pop up on some of the national media outlets that I just frequent on a regular basis, just when I'm checking out new music. And so seeing that at the same time was like, wow, this kid really has a good strategy. You know, it seems like he has a good team behind him. And for everybody, for luckily, the music was really good, too. So it was really cool to see. And he's just, you know, he's just a regular kid and just really speaking about his dreams, his aspirations, where he grew up. I think he grew up a little bit in Racine, but also showcasing Racine, Milwaukee, just this whole area. And he has, you know, just getting a lot of love from a lot of people. So that was really cool to see, along with another artist named Webster X, who just came out last year. But his first video probably had at least 50 different artists, MCs, just musicians in his video. And so you could just see that collaboration and that, you know, togetherness that it's always cool to see, especially from younger artists.
We're going to listen to both of those artists. We're going to start off with Ishtar, and this is his song, The Better Life.
All right.
They say he do things different, cause I was shoestring missing, cause I was Wu-Tang kicking. I got on two chains drifting, with my two mains drifting. Two lanes switching in yard, never had flavor. I was Kool-Aid dipping, pray for the life that I'm living. The sins I'm committing, the chicks I be hitting, probably the liquor I'm spilling, probably the rocket that shot me to get this spitting with Shoppy, so I can stop worrying about getting some OGs from Poppy and buy my own thing. Don't believe it, just watch me. I got the power like we energies, but fits like I'm Garvey.
And there's Ishtar with his song, The Better Life.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, a young guy. And also watching this video, he's got Milwaukee front and center
right
there. Is the city something that this new generation of rappers is proud of?
Very proud of. Everybody who's emceeing now and really trying to take a hold of things, they are always talking about Milwaukee, always speaking highly of it, because especially from where they're from, they don't feel like it gets represented enough. So we see a lot of great things in the national scene, just in general about Milwaukee with tourism and people wanting to come here for business opportunities. But they're really speaking on, you know, the music side and what they go through. And they know there's such great things that don't get the shine that they feel they deserve. So they're all speaking about it in a positive way. And it was interesting with Ishtar in particular. He was on my radio show. And he was saying, you know, his parents listened to A Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and all that. And you can kind of hear those elements in that music with his soul, so with that soul, the, you know, the jazz elements. And so for me, it was interesting. Like, your parents listened to that music? How old does that make me? You know what I mean? But it was really just cool to hear him talk about that and know that history and, you know, really make music in that same vein.
And we got to get to Webster X, too. This is a song of his called Desperate Youth.
Mm-hmm.
What? Fatigue all in me. What? Thought this was easy. Butterflies in my stomach, nervous for a purpose. Feeling worthless, same kids on your curb. Spilling 40 ounces all over your stoop. Desperate Youth, digesting you. Digress the truth. Between never die, but die. Same kids hungry for the money. What? Same kids giving out the money. What? We're pushing this art to be known. Bobotosa used to be the safest song. What? Until he put the chrome, put it at the dome. Almost saw my brain business blown. But I forget the home.
And the song there called Desperate Youth by Webster X. We heard a little reference there to Wauwatosa. So again, a really local song. What do you hear in that one?
I just hear just his own individuality and some his creativity. Like, you know, when you meet Webster X, he's a very cool dude, but also very weird in a good way, you know. And so it's cool to see him be as free as he wants in his music. And, you know, like I said, with him, with Ishtar, with other artists like the ones are on Unify Records, Dana Cop and Speakeasy and Pizzle, all very different sounds. So when you listen to Ishtar, when you listen to Webster X, you get two very different vibes. But it's still from the same city, coming from this love of home and speaking about all the different aspects. So his album, which was also called Desperate Youth and Webster X, he spoke about some of the real issues going on with race and just politics and everything, along with the music scene, along with his love for hip hop. So again, these young artists, along with the more established artists like the Pizzles, like the Profs, and like the Unified Records, really speaking about all of these different things in a very creative way to make anybody. So if depending on whatever your style is, you're going to want to listen. You're going to want to pay attention.
So as we wrap up here, looking ahead, do you think that Milwaukee could ever become a big destination for hip-hop artists, independent of the coast.
Yeah, for sure, especially since these artists right now are already starting to get that attention that we've been looking for. Because the issue has been, okay, we have all of these talented artists. We have all this creativity. We have all this interesting music. But how do we get it out, especially being so close to other major cities? And especially, you know, trying to build more venues and trying to get more national acts to come around. The fact that people can now look at national media outlets and see Milwaukee on the list, that'll make them want to pay attention more. So I think, you know, within a few years, and, you know, people have been saying that for a long time, but there, I don't feel there was ever any evidence. You know, there was never any proof. It was just kind of hopes. And I think now, for sure, there is definite proof that if you're a newer artist or if you're even established, you can really get seen on these national scales, and people are going to want to come and see what's going on and pay attention and make some music. And that was shown through another artist, Wave Chappelle.
And I'm sorry, we got to leave it there. We're out of time. Bizon, thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us.
For sure. Glad to be here. Thank you.
We were talking to DJ Bizon, Milwaukee-based DJ. He's one half of the show Those Hip Hop Guys, which airs Tuesday nights from 9 to midnight on WMSC 91.7 in Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It definitely seems that technology is everywhere these days. Sure, we're likely to think about the computers, the smartphones, can't seem to live without them. But according to our next guest, it's starting to show up in places we might not expect and can get pretty invasive.
It's a phenomenon he calls techno creep, and he says that while we may benefit from some of these technologies, we do so at the expense of our privacy, and that's kind of concerned about what the very near future could look like.
Joining us now is Thomas Keenan. He's a fellow of the Canadian Information Processing Society and the Canadian Defense and Foreign Affairs Institute. He's the author of the new book, Techno Creep, The Surrender of Privacy and the Capitalization of Intimacy. Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Rob.
Well, let's start with this basic idea of techno creep. We've seen rising technology, computer technology, for some time now. When do you see it turning toward a creepifying side?
Yeah, the premise is that there's stuff going on in the background that we just don't know about. I was looking at the ad for an estate sale, and I clicked on the picture of a chandelier, and all of a sudden I see an ad for chandeliers.com up in the corner. And I'm thinking, you know, how do they know? Are they mind readers? Now, I looked into the file, and it was chandelier.jpg was the name of the file, so I convinced myself that was it. But then I read that Google has visual recognition, image recognition technology. Maybe they're looking at everything we look at. And the creepy part is we don't know. This is all secret sauce within governments and companies, and it's all going on around us.
So what kind of information are we voluntarily, in some cases, involuntarily in others, giving up without really being aware of it?
Just about everything we know. You know, I think a lot about technology merging with our bodies, and in the future it will. We'll have, you know, implantable technology. But people are already wearing fitness monitors. And, you know, the idea is you leave them on 24-7 because you want to track all your paces. I know a guy who his Facebook page every day says, Bill took 1,427 steps today. Well, that Nike Fuel Band, as someone pointed out, knows a lot about you. For example, if you burn 150 calories at 2 in the morning and you're a male and you took zero steps, it might decide that you're having sex. And so, you know, the reality is your fuel band could make that deduction if it's so programmed. And it could tell people, it could tweet it, it could put it on your Facebook. Hopefully we can control it, but I'm suggesting that it's not always quite within our control.
Now, most of us are not celebrities. We're not famous. Mostly people around the world aren't that interested in our doings and where we're going. So aren't we safe in our relative obscurity?
No, you're not. I mean, there's a great film called Terms and Conditions May Apply. It's a fascinating film, and they estimate that if you use YouTube and Gmail and Google Drive and those things, you're worth about $500 a year to Google. And you can't really go to Google and say, no, here's $500. I don't want to be tracked. I don't want you to be reading my mail with robots and stuff like that. It all just kind of happens. So the reality is there's this value that's imputed to your information, and, you know, some of that information can be quite valuable. It can also be quite sensitive. It could be you searched on a particular medical condition.
So the worry here isn't always the one particular thing, just what we put on Facebook or just what we search for or just what we buy at the drugstore, say. But
Yes. You
write about a lot of ways that companies, apps, individuals are able to start putting all those things together to form a picture of us. How do they do that?
That's exactly the thing. They aggregate it. There's a program called Spokio, and I have a 27-year-old son, and I just put his email address in, and they came up with facts about him, kind of where he lives and, you know, things, what social networks he's on. And this is all for free. I didn't buy their premium network, their premium access. So I call him up and say, I heard you like a certain band. And he said, how'd you know that? And I said, it's from your playlist on Last.fm. How'd you know I have a playlist on that? I said, it's all out there. I just needed your email. Your email is like your social security number. It ties all these things together. And, you know, the reality is you can creep on people that way.
Well, and here's how it starts to get creepy. There's an app you write about. I forget what it's called. Girls Around You, something like that.
Girls Around Me.
Around Me. I guess that didn't make it big. But how did that work, and just how creepy was that?
That one was very creepy. If you had this app on your phone, you could walk into a bar, push a button, and it would do two things. It would look for all the young ladies who had checked in on Foursquare, which a lot of young people do. I was just in an office today, and it said, here, check in on Foursquare. If you check in the most times in a month, you'll be the mayor of this place. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, young people do that. This app unified that with Facebook profiles. So if the girls had not secured their Facebook profiles, you could not only see that they were there in that bar, but you could see, oh, Sally's not in a relationship, and her favorite band is the Bare Naked Ladies. I think I'll go have a chat with Sally. And I just thought that was really creepy that one person could have that power on their phone, and poor Sally over there has no idea what's going on.
All right, now let's keep adding to the creepiness. Facial recognition. How does that change the equation?
It's getting really, really good. I mean, for starters, you know, you had to stop smiling about 10 years ago for your passport, and that's all about facial recognition technology. We had a situation in Vancouver, B.C. in 2011 where there were riots, and the police got lots of video. They had their own surveillance cameras. They had citizens sending in video, and it became a big privacy question. Do you actually use those faces to try to track the people? And if so, where do you look them up? Can you look them up in the driver's license database? And the Privacy Commissioner of British Columbia had to rule on that. But it's all moved so far since 2011. My own Calgary, I live in Calgary, Alberta, my police department there just became the first in North America to take crime scene videos and analyze them by facial recognition. And, you know, I was asked, is this a good idea? And I said, well, the technology is not good or bad. It's what data they feed into it. If they feed in, you know, somebody mugged somebody and we can identify them, that's great. If they feed in everybody walking down the street and we know where everybody's going, that's not so great.
And talk about the commercial world now. We see security cameras on the way into Target, grocery stores, you name it. Is there a commercial future where I walk into a store, there's facial recognition, it builds up a profile of me, and they know how to sell things to me? I don't know what else.
It's worse. Mondelez International, which makes, you know, such well-known products as Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy cookies, they're experimenting with smart shelves that will have sensors in them. As you walk by, it won't know exactly who you are, but it'll figure out, are you a man or a woman? What's your body mass index? Are you a likely candidate for a 2-for-1 coupon just for you on Oreos right now? And if you are, it might display. I thought that was creepy till I found out that in Australia, they actually have a speaker that speaks only to you. It's called Audio Spotlight. It's a focus beam of sound, and you stand in the produce department. It says, hello, you can hear me, but nobody else can. I'm the voice of your conscience. You know you should buy those fair trade bananas. And it worked. The sales went up 152%.
So the message I'm hearing from you is, you know, maybe while we're online and surfing or entering data and passwords, maybe if we're somewhat savvy, we're thinking about this stuff. But this is going on when we're nowhere near our computer, not even actually actively using our smartphones.
Absolutely. There were some trash bins in the financial district in London that actually were set to record the cell phone IDs of everyone going by. Now, they didn't know whose cell phone it was, but we all know. The phone company knows. The government knows. So, you know, it's not that hard to find out. And they could actually say between 12:03 and 12:07 every day, this particular phone obviously walks by on the way to lunch. So there's that kind of tracking. It's a bit like, you know, the TV show Person of Interest. There's that kind of tracking that goes on in the background, invisibly, and you have no idea that it's happening except that it is.
And we might assume that we're safe from our computers, our TV sets, while they're off. You also write about, and this got some news a while back, people being able to hack into the cameras. Then it was on laptop computers, I think, but more and more TVs have these. We can be observed while we don't know it.
I was at the Black Hat Conference in Las Vegas, and this Korean guy gets up and he says, I don't like to wear clothes much. And the reporters are all kind of sitting there going, yeah, so what? And then he goes, but I worry about my girlfriend and my mother walking in front of the TV. And we say, well, you know, what's she talking about? He had figured out a way to turn on the camera, and it was the Samsung Smart TV. And even when the set was off, he was able to activate the camera. And as you mentioned, in laptops there are cameras. Miss Teen USA, Cassidy Wolf, discovered that this guy had pictures of her taken in her bedroom because he turned on the camera. And he's in jail now, which is where he belongs.
And it's going beyond computers now as we computerify and network appliances, refrigerators, thermostats. Is this another area for worry?
Absolutely. I mean, I saw a demonstration this year on the Nest thermostat, which is a programmable thermostat. The company's owned by Google, and the reality is this guy was able to hack it. If he got physical access, he could grab your thermostat. He could turn it up, turn it down, make it display everything. And I thought, well, that's not so bad. He has to break into your house. Then the next session was on hacking automobiles, and they get into the car area network through the Bluetooth entertainment system or something frivolous like that. Then they can blow the horn. They can lower the windows. They could even apply the brakes.
We're talking with cyber expert Thomas Keenan about his new book, Techno Creep. He says technology is getting more and more invasive without a lot of us realizing it. You can join the conversation, too, at 800-642-1234.
Well, what creeps you out about modern technology? Do you have questions about who's doing what with your information and where they're getting it from? And what are the benefits and drawbacks you see to all of this technology? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with author and cybersecurity expert Thomas Keenan in his new book, Techno Creep. He says new technologies are invading our privacy like never before. He's speaking out on who's using our info for what and where they're getting it from. You can join in with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Thomas, we scared people there for a little bit. Is there anything we can do? Are there a couple of basic steps that we can take to limit how much of our info is out there and how much people can use it?
Absolutely. The first one I caught, be info stingy. So you walk into a store and they want your zip code, postal code, whatever. In Canada, we have alphanumeric ones, so you can give ho, 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 which actually gets the mail to Santa Claus. I guess you guys can use 90210 or something like that. But the reality is stores don't need that unless you're expecting mail from them or something. They're just trying to work into their marketing system, you know, and do some kind of marketing analysis. There was a guy who actually, Safeway cards are great cards. They get you a discount. You'd be stupid not to have one. But when I signed up, you know, I gave an address in Bangkok. This guy went one step beyond. He published his barcode. People printed it off, slapped it on their card. So at any given time, hundreds of these guys, same guy, we're shopping at Safeway stores. And it's just almost symbolic. Safeway, in the big scheme of things, doesn't care. But it kind of sends the signal that you want to be careful with your information.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got Jan on the line in La Crosse. Jan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I heard your guest mention the Samsung Smart TV and that it can be accessed remotely, and I own one of those. And I'm wondering, is there anything that I would be able to see, a light or anything on the TV, to know if somebody has accessed my TV in my home without my knowledge?
The answer to that is the power light would go on, but I have a really simple fix for you, which is a piece of tape over that lens. The only reason that lens is there is if you want to, you know, have Skype conversations through your TV. 99% of people never use that camera. It's kind of a dumb feature. So, you know, a post-it note or something like that over the lens is probably the safest thing to do.
That's a cheap fix. Good luck, Jan. That sounds not too complicated. I will go to Tim with us now in Manitouish Waters. Tim, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, quite honestly, there's a radio show that I listen to out of Texas daily, and this guy has been talking about it for 10, 15 years on how technologies will be used to completely invade our privacy, and it will show trends because they can get inside information on people, what they're saying, what they're doing. What they use and how they use it in their houses. It could honestly be warfare at some point.
Absolutely. I mean, there are apps that can turn on your phone and eavesdrop on you. There's one in Brazil called Boyfriend Tracker, and girls are putting this on their boyfriend's phone, and everywhere he goes, they can hear the conversations. So, you know, every time we trust technology, we got to think twice about it. You're absolutely right.
Tim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Thomas, how much was this a conscious design? People were designing this technology with the idea that we're going to track this data, and how much of it was just unintended consequences? Oh, we have this fancy stuff. Oh, we can track this stuff.
I got examples of both. The one that's most famous is Target knows teenage girl is pregnant before her father. Great story in the New York Times by a reporter who determined that Target was able to tell, and they're really interested in pregnant women because they spend a lot of money, and they were able to find out that this girl was pregnant. They started sending her pregnancy-oriented ad flyers, and her dad storms into the store, and he says, "She's only 16. Are you encouraging her to have sex?" And so the store apologizes. 2 weeks later, the dad apologizes. "Well, there were some things going on at my house I didn't know about. She's due in August." Now, the creepy thing is what Target did about it. They didn't just stop sending this stuff because she's worth money. They started mixing in power drills and, you know, wine glasses and barbecues, things that pregnant women don't care about, because their theory was if she doesn't know we're doing it, it's not creepy.
Now, technology is changing super quickly, computer technology in particular. By the time, say, Congress tackles an issue or it works its way up through the courts, we're having an argument about what happened 3 years ago. Where do solutions to concerns like this come from?
Great question. One of the things that bugs a lot of people, and we luckily don't have it in Canada, are mugshot databases. You get yourself arrested in Hernando County, Florida. Sheriff Al will put your photograph up on his website, you know, because he wants to show that he's doing a job. He's been elected. However, there's a nasty site called mugshots.com that scrapes those images off and puts them up there as a public service so you can see who's been arrested. And that sounds great until you see the little unpublishing link for like $499, Visa or MasterCard. They will take down your photo. So they're a business. Now, the state of Oregon passed a law kind of limiting these people, but they find ways around it. What's really going to solve it is technology. So if Google starts downranking, as they can do, mugshots, you know, so a life that's been exemplary life, you know, you have one mugshot up there, it shouldn't be at the top, it should be at the bottom. And if the credit card companies stop letting these people take their money, then, you know, people are going to have to use Bitcoin or something to pay them.
Okay, but if I'm a concerned citizen, I might go to the effort of talking to a state legislator or my congressional representative. How do I take on the task of lobbying Google and all credit card companies and, you know, people who handle PayPal, whoever I would need to go to try to change this?
Probably with your pocketbook. I mean, how you shop and where you shop. My friend Ann Cavoukian, who is the Privacy Commissioner of Ontario, says privacy is going to become something that businesses, you know, cite as an advantage, like we protect your privacy. I don't think we've quite come there because it's so tempting. You get that wonderful data. I'm predicting that because of DNA technology, something called touch DNA, in the future, you're going to walk into a store, and if you use the pin pad will be whisked away, just like one of those disposable toilet cover seats, and they will do an instant DNA analysis of you. And the next time you come into that store, they'll say, "Did you know you're pre-diabetic? We have a special deal for you on pre-diabetic vitamins or something."
That sounds creepy. Well, Colleen on Facebook writes, "Okay, I am officially creeped out, and I consider myself a somewhat savvy tech user. How can we protect ourselves but still take benefit of the awesome technologies out there?"
Excellent question. And, you know, surveillance technology is not all bad. We had a woman in Ontario who forgot, I don't know how you do this, that she bought a lottery ticket, and it won $50 million. And they found her through a combination of credit card records and a surveillance camera in a drugstore. And she was very happy that they had surveillance cameras. So it's not all bad. One thing to think about is try not to leave too much of a digital trail with your email. It's so easy to unify things. So I tell people, have a bunch of different emails. You can have as many as you want. Just make them up for different purposes. So one's for work, one's for home, one's for magazine subscriptions. It'll help to organize your life a little bit. It will also keep somebody from using that as a master key to put everything about you together.
You know, Thomas, we drive cars and accept the risks of an accident in exchange for the benefits of getting places fast. ultimately, do we just have to accept the risks of government and corporate intrusion, potential stalking, identity theft, all that, to reap the benefits that we get from the communication, the convenience that we get from the high-tech world?
I think we have to think of each one kind of case by case, and there certainly are benefits. But if I got a car now, knowing what I know about carjacking, you know, through the remote accessing and hacking of cars, I would actually check that list of cars. I know the Cadillac Escalade is up at the top of most hackable cars, and I would probably go into my car and disable some of those features. I mean, there's certainly people out there who might try that stuff. So, you know, there's a way to have a middle ground where you can actually get most of the benefits, but you don't just make yourself a total sucker. I mean, right now there's a bug running around just this week that affects Apple's iPhones and iPads, and it has to do with people accepting, oh, you want the new Flappy Birds, right, click here. Well, be skeptical. Maybe you don't need the new Flappy Birds, and maybe that's not from Flappy Birds.
So, Thomas, briefly as you wrap up, all this research you've done on these issues hasn't turned you into a neo-Luddite?
No, but, you know, actually, I see the benefits. Like, I go on Amazon, and I learn about new books because I see people who bought TechnoCreep also bought this book and this book, this one on how Las Vegas uses your data. But, you know, one story that sticks with me from that, people who bought Call of Duty, the video game, also bought disposable diapers. So sometimes we can learn social trends that we don't want to know about just from those buying patterns.
Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Thomas Keenan. His new book is Techno Creep, The Surrender of Privacy and the Capitalization of Intimacy.